Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the LGC News Roundup podcast. My name's Martin George. I'm the deputy editor. I'm joined by Megan Kenyon, our senior reporter. Hi, Megan.
Hi, Martin.
And Kirsty Weekly, our head of content. Hi, Kirsty.
Hi, Martin.
So we're recording this the afternoon after the Lionesses' fabulous victory in the World Cup semi-final. Megan sitting here on Teams wearing her England top, which is great to see. And I just thought, but it's been really nice seeing all the council leaders tweeting about the Lionesses from their pack who, you know, helped drive England to their first World Cup final since 1966. So a real pride in place there, I think, from the World Cup. So hopefully that'll help bring communities together. That's about the only optimistic thing we're talking about today. So with that done, we're going to be talking about whether councils are letting their residents down when it comes to antisocial behaviour. We'll be looking at why a number of councils lent millions of pounds to Woking Council, despite knowing it was in danger of going bankrupt. And we'll be talking to one of Britain's most respected think tanks about why the council funding system needs to change. Let's start, Megan, with that antisocial behaviour point. Often local government folk think they get a bit of a kicking in the national media unfairly. So they'll have groaned when they saw the BBC's headline this morning saying that councils are failing to tackle antisocial behaviour, Watchdog says. But it feels like that's probably quite a justified criticism today. What are we talking about? When we talk about antisocial behaviour, what are we looking at, Megan?
Yeah, so antisocial behaviour kind of spans a lot of different issues, from whether someone is parked in an inconsiderate way to loud music, being able to kind of get the council to kind of help you to tell your neighbours to shut up, basically. But it can also extend to, you know, sort of more serious things like harassment and that kind of bad behaviour between neighbours and things like that. So, yeah, it's a wide range of things. I think it's quite difficult to completely define what it is. But, yeah, I mean, there's been a lot, you know, kind of a lot of discussion about it recently. I know the Onward think tank did some work on it earlier this year, which I know that Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove was kind of involved in the discussion around. And, you know, there was stuff from DLUC earlier this year on antisocial behaviour. So definitely seems to be sort of a key area of discussion that probably will come up over the next sort of year, 18 months as we go into the next election.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, the new piece in this picture, of course, it's a report by the Local Government and Social Care Ombudsman. It's worth saying, actually, that this is Paul Nagsarak. He's not by any means a critical figure for local government. He's a former chief executive of Ealing Council. So, you know, someone worth listening to, given he's a friend of the sector. Megan, what does the report say?
It found that the Ombudsman has upheld about three quarters of the complaints that have come to it, which is obviously quite a lot of complaints. I think that, you know, what the Ombudsman kind of found was just that councils don't necessarily seem to be doing enough to tackle this issue. I think that there was definitely some sort of concern from the Ombudsman around, I think, resourcing, but it also councils knowing what tools are at their disposal and kind of using all of the tools that they have in their kind of arsenal. But yeah, I think that there was just sort of, I don't think the Ombudsman was necessarily having a go at councils, but saying, you know, this is a big issue, one that affects a lot of residents, and you kind of need to step up on it. I think we can all, you know, we've spoken on this podcast numerous times about councils not quite having the funding and resourcing to be able to do everything that is expected of them. But I think it's slightly more nuanced in this, in that I think councils aren't quite, you know, flexing their muscles as much as they could, if that makes sense.
Kirsty.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's because a lot of these antisocial behaviour issues are quite subjective, aren't they? It's not always easy to tell when one person's loud music is someone else's antisocial behaviour. So it's where you really do need to have a properly expert and well-resourced team to deal with it, to recognise those real problems as against, you know, as opposed to something that is maybe just should be sorted out between neighbours.
Yeah, a case study in the report was that a man who had reported his neighbour's 13-hour party, which is crazy. Who can have a 13-hour party? I definitely can't. But he had reported it to the council and been told he would need to report similar incidents, within a 25-day period for the council to take action. So I think there was some sort of criticism levelled at councils about gatekeeping specific measures that they could take, you know, saying we won't do this unless you do that, you know, whereas some issues, particularly serious issues, there's not really room for that. You know, this is people's lives at the end of the day. And I think, like, you know, living with unpleasant neighbours or as unpleasant behaviour in your kind of community, no one really deserves to be subjected to that.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a quality of life issue, isn't it? I think one thing that struck me about the report, there's this thing called the community trigger, where someone who's, you know, made complaints about antisocial behaviour, they can ask for this multi-agency review of their complaints. The report's sort of saying that's poorly publicised, that it's made inaccessible by unnecessary bureaucracy. So it does feel as if, you know, there is a bit of blame being put at the door councils here. And, you know, they should be perhaps braced for more criticism, as you said, Megan, as the general election approaches and this sort of quality of life, quality of place issue that comes up in all these focus groups just comes to the fore even more. Moving on from one depressing story to another, Woking. We've talked about Woking before. It's a council with an astonishing financial mess that it's got itself into. But Megan, you've been working with Jack Shaw, who's a local government researcher, to find out some figures about other councils that have been lending it millions of pounds, despite knowing that it was a really financially troubled institution. Tell us a bit about that.
So Jack Shaw sent in a Freedom of Information request to Woking, which asked them about inter-authority lending, how much money they'd borrowed from other councils over the past sort of 3 years. And when we got this FOI back, I was kind of able to analyse, you know, which councils had lent Woking the money. It's not just councils, combined authorities as well, when they had lent Woking the money and how much. And we found six had lent Woking money after Woking put out a statement earlier this year, I think it was in February, saying they were in section 114 territory. Now, I think everyone in the sector would know when a council says they're in section 114 territory, their financial situation is not exactly rosy. So
exactly. We just to be clear, section 114, that's when a council basically says we're bankrupt.
Yes, and they can only run essential services. So we kind of looked into this, and there are a couple of loans which had taken place even after the Section 114 notice had been issued. I think it's an interesting one because it's not illegal, and actually it's, you know, it's looked upon by the sector as a good way of covering when, you know, say your council tax is due in next week, but you need to spend money on something today or tomorrow, but the money that you were going to use was going to come from the council tax, the money you'd raise from council tax. You might then ask one of your friendly other councils, can I borrow, you know, £5 million off you to just cover this, and I'll pay you back as soon as I get this money in. So it's not something that is frowned upon by the sector. It's actually used quite a lot. But I think that the governance around it, there are questions which do need to be asked. spoke to Sitfa, who said that in 99% of cases, this is done well.
And of course, I mean, Sitfa, quite an authoritative voice. They're sort of the Chartered Institute, aren't they, for public finance and accountancy.
Yes.
So moving on from one specific council and its financial problems, Kirsty, you had a chat with Kate Ogden of the Institute for Fiscal Studies about a big piece of work they've done about the funding system for local public services, particularly in our case, local authorities. Should we have a listen to what you and Kate had to say, and then we'll come back and then just see how optimistic we are that these problems are going to be fixed.
I'm now joined by Kate Ogden, a senior research economist from the Institute for Fiscal Studies, and one of the authors of some new research about how much public funding each area receives and whether it has been allocated sensibly. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
So what were the IFS looking for and what did you find?
So we were looking to understand the amount of funding that different areas in England receive for a range of really key public services. So we looked at NHS, schools, local government, public health and police. And we wanted to understand how far the funding areas receive varies across the country, how that varies, and whether that variation reflects how much different areas might need to deliver services. So we found for local government, looking at council tax, business rates and grants, the level of funding areas received varies a lot. So from £630 per head in Trafford up to £1,330 in Camden, so more than twice as much. And funding tends to be higher in inner London, in deprived parts of the North East and North West, and local government funding is lowest in kind of affluent suburbs. Now, the amount of funding areas need to deliver sort of those services will also vary a lot because local populations have different demands. An area with more sort of poor people or more sick people might need more funding, and they also have different costs of delivering services. So we look at what would funding allocations look like if the total pot of local government funding nationally was given to areas to enable them to provide a consistent level of services across the country. So we're not taking a judgment on whether the total pot of funding for local government is big enough. We're just looking at whether the pot that exists is shared between areas in a way that looks fair based on what their different needs are. We find there are really big mismatches between the amount of funding areas receive and their share of needs. And these are particularly stark for local government. So for the NHS, for instance, these funding allocations look relatively close to patterns of need. But for local government, we see there's not really much relationship between what funding areas have and what we estimate they need. And there are some really stark examples. So Wokingham receives 45% more funding than if it received just its needs share. Hounslow receives 30% less funding. And it's very common that we see areas that have sort of similar levels of need receiving really different levels of funding. So Trafford and Dorset, as two examples, have very similar estimated needs for local government funding, but Trafford receives £300 per person less.
And do you have any idea why there are such disparities in local government?
So one part of it is how cuts in the 2010s were delivered. They didn't reflect the different reliance of different areas on government grants compared to locally raised revenues. So more deprived areas, which relied more on government grant funding, saw bigger overall cuts during the 2010s than more affluent areas. And we see this this coming through in even in 2022, that the most deprived fifth of areas receive 9% less funding than their share of needs, and the most affluent areas receive 15% more funding than we think they need. So we see this really stark pattern by deprivation still coming through. It doesn't look like these patterns are all explained by how much council tax different areas are raising. We might be less worried if it's that, you know, deprived areas have decided to set lower council tax bills and accept lower service levels. But when we look instead at what areas would get if they set just the average level of council tax, we still see really stark differences.
I think it's also worth touching on the findings regarding public health, because there are also quite some stark differences there, weren't there?
Yeah, there really are. So we look particularly at the public health grant, which is relatively small compared to, for instance, local government funding, but it looks particularly poorly targeted. So Kensington Chelsea receives 116% more than its share of need, and Slough 35% less. Now, we see quite different patterns to local government. So interestingly, it doesn't look like it's the most deprived areas that are being disadvantaged on public health. Instead, it looks like it's rural and suburban areas which are losing out compared to their kind of share of needs.
And so having done this mammoth amount of work, what are your recommendations?
First, mostly that DLUHC needs to go away and do a mammoth amount of work to fix it. So one thing we had to do in this report was try to update the needs assessments for different areas, because for local government, these haven't been updated since 2013. And a lot has changed since then. A lot of the data underlying those needs assessments are from the 2001 census. There are some bits in there from the early 1990s, which at this point is just kind of inexcusable. It's a very poor measure of what different areas might need now. So we've gone through and plugged in kind of updated data to the existing formulas. Really, the government needs to go away and totally re-estimate what it is that different areas need to deliver services, for particularly for local government, also for police and for public health. And once they've got those updated estimates of what different areas need, they then need to use these in some transparent way to actually allocate funding between areas. Now, they might not want to just give all areas their kind of needs share of funding. There are other aims that the government has. So for instance, things like the new homes bonus or business rates retention are intended to give areas incentives to promote development. You might still want to keep some of those bits that move funding slightly away from needs, but we really think they need to be transparent about how they're trading off these different aims in the funding system.
And what are the sort of practicalities of resetting the system? You know, are there going to be people losing out, and how do we manage that?
So this comes back to the kind of size of the total pot question. We haven't taken a view on whether the total pot of funding is sufficient to deliver particular outcomes in particular places. But the system for allocating between areas clearly isn't fit for purpose. Now, if you take the existing total pot and allocate it out in different ways, there clearly will be both winners and losers from this. Now, we think this means it will take several years to fix and to move over to a more rational system. And that makes sense. You know, you wouldn't want areas that are kind of even relatively overfunded now to lose out a lot in a short space of time. You want to kind of smooth things over time. But the longer they leave this, the worse it gets, and the bigger those losers eventually, you know, the bigger the changes the losers will eventually have to see.
And lastly, as part of this work, you've also produced a really useful interactive tool. Do you want to talk us through what that tool shows and how people might be able to use it to help them?
Yes, we have. So it's a tool on the IFS website, produced by my great colleague Max. And you can use it to look at all of these results for any specific local area in the country. It's got nice maps and tables. You can download everything, so you can see results for your area across the different services. And you can also compare two areas. You can look by deprivation and all sorts of other things. So there's lots you can do. We really hope people use it to kind of engage in the work and understand things at a local level.
So Kirsty, Kate talked very much about the how the cake is divided up rather than the size of the cake, as it were. Do you think, is there any optimism that either the cake will get bigger or that the way it's divided up will be fixed in the way she says it needs to be?
I think we'd all always argue for bigger cakes. But I think realistically, the chances of any cakes getting bigger, given the current public finances, are, it's unlikely. But it's a sensible discussion to start having, because if you if you look at, you know, the way things are divided up, and if you look at the one, you know, if you look at the areas that are getting proportionally more than maybe they should have, if things were divided up more fairly, and they say, but we're only, you know, we're only just managing with the money we've got. Actually, you're going to have some really serious discussions about how do you make that transition, and should some extra top up level funding or growing the size of the cake be part of that? Otherwise, reform won't happen and things will just continue to get worse.
Yeah, I think it's remembering back to last December when the government announced the current local government funding settlement. That was actually seen as relatively generous compared to previous years, but, you know, didn't in any way fix the issues. And I guess, you know, I mean, there's been a long history, hasn't there, of the government saying this is a problem and we are going to look at it, how the money is divided, but not actually delivering the solution into council coffers.
Yeah, so I think the fair funding review has been promised since 2016. So in a, and that's, you know, the longer we leave things, as Kate was saying, the harder they become to resolve. So actually, it really needs some brave politicians to really grasp the nettle here and sort it out. Given that we've got an election coming up and everything else is going on, I wouldn't be placing any bets on it happening anytime soon. But I think it's still worth, you know, sort of everyone in the sector trying to keep this issue as close to the top of the agenda as possible, so that it is fresh in people's mind when there is the time and space to knuckle down and get it sorted.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks very much. So we always like to finish on a slightly positive note. We can't do that definitely, but we'll certainly say good luck to the Lionesses on Sunday. Hopefully we'll have more council leaders tweeting about victorious local heroes. In the meantime, do subscribe to this podcast, like it, share it with your friends. Look out for our other podcast, The Local Authority, which has a deeper dive into some of the issues facing the sector. And do keep track of all our news stories day to day on our website, lgcplus.com. But for now, thanks for listening.